Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the gathering gloom over Afghanistan, where the 2,000th U.S. soldier was killed by Afghan allies, and the U.S. general in charge just told 60 Minutes that we're willing to sacrifice a lot for this campaign, but we're not willing to be murdered for it. A former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan, Chris Fair, joins us to discuss an accelerated exit from Afghanistan and the likely civil war to follow. Then we'll examine another futile war in a failed state, Somalia, where Kenyan soldiers have just driven out the Al-Shabaab militia and captured the port of Kismayo that has long been used by pirates. Robert Young-Pelton, the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, joins us to discuss the newly assertive Kenyan military and his article at Foreign Policy, Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Then finally, we will discuss what we won't be hearing in Wednesday night's presidential debate with Mattia Kramer, the senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project. She has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Tough Talk for America, a guide to the presidential debates you won't hear. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And the Marine Corps General John Allen, the commander of the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, on 60 Minutes on Sunday said, "We're willing to sacrifice a lot for this campaign, but we're not willing to be murdered for it." I guess morale has to be pretty low, doesn't it? If with these green on blue killings, what's your sense of what's happening in the field there with our troops?
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it. I mean, this has been going on now for quite a number of years. I'm surprised it hasn't drawn more attention than it has. I'm a little bit baffled by General Allen's comments, of course, because, you know, I think if you were to take a look at the broad campaign, we have indeed sacrificed quite a bit, and the gains are not quite evident to me. You know, we went into Afghanistan to oust al-Qaeda. Well, al-Qaeda's been ousted for quite some time. And at some point, the goal became, you know, defeating the Taliban. And I think that when the goal went from ousting al-Qaeda to defeating the Taliban, the United States didn't really appreciate that it was essentially pitting itself against Pakistan, right, in a sort of weird proxy war because the Taliban are their allies. And so we really found ourselves in the last couple of years trying to find some way of honorably getting out of Afghanistan, you know, if it's not cutting and running, then severing and sauntering. But the problem, of course, keeps just coming back to Pakistan. And they're pretty much have shown themselves to be very capable of doing everything in their power to undermine the kind of outcome that we'd like to see in Afghanistan. So it's really hard to understand what the benefits have been after all of the sacrifice of life and treasure.
And Christine Fair, you're a student of Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. What are the Pakistani leadership thinking? Presumably, since the joke's always been that it's not a country with a military, but a military with a country or an army with a country. Presumably, they must have thought about when the ISAF and the U.S. get out. And if they've been supporting the Taliban and they want them to take over Afghanistan, won't that mean that would therefore blow back on them, a radical regime in Afghanistan? Wouldn't that encourage radicals within Pakistan that the government is already having a hard time with?
So, I mean, this is what the Pakistanis officially say. I mean, this is the kind of rationale when they say, why would we be supporting the Haqqani network? Boy, what a bunch of untruths that are, you know. So this is the official story that the Pakistanis say. They tell this to Americans. They tell this to anyone that will listen. But that narrative is really fundamentally belied by a sort of larger look at the region. The reason why Pakistan has been so adamant in supporting the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban, and I know to your listeners who don't follow South Asia, it's going to sound insane, but the Pakistanis are absolutely fearful of India's ability to take advantage of any position in Afghanistan. And to Pakistan's credit, or to give some credibility to its claims, You know, the Indians have been able to expand their footprint relative to what it was before 9/11 under the U.S. security umbrella. And so the Pakistanis, in some sense, this goes all the way back to the first day when Pakistan became an independent state. Afghanistan opposed its admissions to the U.N. Afghanistan has taken a lot of positions that are deeply vexing to Pakistan, but it... In Pakistan's narrative, it does so at the urging, at the behest, at the instigation of, and with the support of India. So, from Pakistan's point of view, in some sense, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So they've been saying, the Americans are going to leave. You came in with a light footprint. You never adopted the right footprint. You outsourced your security to the Northern Alliance, which Pakistan views as an Indian proxy. And sure enough, you are indeed 11 years later, finally getting out. And so in some sense, that vindicates their strategy of never having let go of the Taliban and the Haqqani network in the first place. And so it's dealing with Pakistan's logic in this region is really quite maddening, I think, on a good day. And I don't think you'll find any U.S. official that's going to disagree with that assessment.
So already the NATO allies in ISAF, which I believe the U.S. military jokingly refers to the acronym ISAF as I Suck at Fighting.
Or I Saw Americans Fight, my other preferred.
Right. So they're already talking about getting out. The first 33,000 U.S. troops have already gotten out, the surge troops, that leaving 68,000 still there. So NATO has currently 108,000 troops, down from 150,000. What's going to happen if NATO, the rest of the NATO soldiers? By the way, they've taken 1,200 deaths compared to the United States 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they've got problems at home, right, with the Euro crisis, et cetera. So give us a sense of how the allies are they going to accelerate our timetable, or events on the ground going to accelerate our timetable?
Well, so when we talk about ISAF, we were really talking about a menagerie of actors. And some of those actors, even though they're a part of the NATO-ISAF coalition, their roles have not always been, to put it bluntly, combat effective. So the Germans, for example, have taken a lot of criticism because of their rules of engagement. So there's this thing called caveats. And they're national caveats. They're essentially limitations on what these countries can do in Afghanistan, and they're very much tied to the domestic politics, speaking to the point that you had alluded to. So when you actually, they actually have tools at NATO-ISAF where you can overlay the battlefield with a caveat to sort of see what is the effective force that you have on the ground that can actually execute certain capabilities. And so, this NATO thing has always been kind of an international fig leaf to what's been an American dominant process. And so many of the partners have pulled out, for example, the Brits have escalated their timelines. The French are under a lot of pressure. The Australians just have a handful of people left. So this is, very much becoming an American dominated affair. I think the bigger question, I think the bigger policy question that's really looming, that the reason why we had the surge in the first place was this fairy tale that the counterinsurgency, the so-called coindanistas or coinistas, as they're sometimes called, sold to the policy community. That is, that if we fight this population-centric counterinsurgency, that we'll be able to win. And that was the logic of the surge. And of course, yours truly, I was very dubious of the whole thing for a number of reasons. But in some sense, you had this entire cottage industry of experts, including David Kilcullen, among others, that were arguing for this kind of approach. And I think what's really become manifestly clear is that it has been a complete failure. And at the end of the day, we put in many more tens of thousands of soldiers. And what's come out of, and what benefits have we realized given the enormous cost, both in terms of life as well as treasury? And it's just really hard to come up with anything that's defensible.
With the 40% of the casualties coming from those crude IEDs, and essentially it was a whack-a-mole situation, wasn't it? They moved into Hamland and Hamland province, the Marines did. They did their job, but then the bad guys melted away, and now they're back. So
that's exactly it. I mean, I kind of use the example of the water balloon, right? You squeeze the water balloon in one place, and the water goes, it displaces someplace else. And I think one of the things that I've always found to be most disingenuous, and I will say disingenuous with full intent that I'm implying deception, a willing effort to manipulate data to deceive. I mean, every Friday they have this thing called the AFPAC Federation Forum, which is nothing but a psyop on the American people. And it's really scandalous, the degree to which there's been so much invested in trying to deceive the American public about the efficacy of what it is that we're doing. So going back to your point, like, you'll see reports that, you know, violence in X district in Helmand are down 30%. But what you don't see is that over there in neighboring Kandahar, violence is up an equivalent percent, or that violence in other districts are up, because essentially, as you said, you know, you put pressure on them in one place and they essentially squirt out to other venues. And so, you know, if you take a look at all of Afghanistan in a total picture, it's really hard to see what we've done that's not been completely reversible. I mean, there were places, you know, in the beginning of this conflict, like Kunduz, for example, that was largely Talib-free. And those large parts of Kunduz that have been at different times overrun by the Taliban, and that's just one area. So I, you know, looking at what we've done and how we've done it, I think it's really hard to make the case to the American public that we should continue being there in this counterinsurgency footing. It's costly. And by the way, one could also say that even if we took Pakistan support for the insurgency off the table and we just focused upon our own war planning, I think there's a lot to be desired in terms of how we understood the battle space. I mean, Jesus, we're still relying upon suspect translators. It's been 11 years, and we don't have language skills. I mean, give me a break. And on top of that, we've had an Afghan partner, obviously Hamid Karzai, that has been pretty much dedicated to remaining a becaped narco-kleptocrat. I mean, we know if we take the counterinsurgency literature seriously, and I'm not necessarily going to say that I do that, but we know that things like governance and accountability and transparency and rule of law, if there's to be any chance of counterinsurgency doctrine prevailing, you need to have those things in the host government. And I don't need to repeat the Afghan government does not in any modest way fulfill those criteria.
Right. Karzai was on 60 Minutes as well, he's somewhat outrageous in suggesting that the U.S. hasn't done enough. And I can imagine it makes people nuts to realizing this absolute, ludicrous, decorated martinet who, I mean, he was brought in by the same neocons that brought in Chalabi, so I'm not surprised. But there was a chance, and I think it was the time when you were working as a U.N. political officer. I remember speaking to Ambassador Galbraith at the time, when the election was so fraudulent that he was pushing to try and get for the U.S. to use the opportunity to get rid of Karzai, and then the U.N. guy, the Norwegian guy, basically thwarted the whole plan. What happened there? Was that a real opportunity to get rid of Karzai?
So, I mean, you know, I think you know I was also a long-term election observer during that fiasco. So there were a couple of problems. The Bush administration, because this was how the Bush administration saw the world, to them, Karzai was indispensable in the same way that Musharraf was indispensable. I mean, Bush had this very personality-driven assessment of the region and how we were going to form alliances. So I was there. You know, I haven't been to Afghanistan now in about 2 years. I'm leaving here in a couple of weeks. But, you know, I had been going there pretty regularly until 2010. And so in 2008, the Karzai election fraud machine was already ticking into gear. And I remember talking to people about this. And, of course, as the as we were moving into the election, by the time you get to 2009 and Obama kind of inherits this hot soup sandwich, the fraud, and by fraud I mean industrial strength fraud. I mean manipulating voter registration. At one point, you could go into the market and buy handfuls of voter registration cards for a ridiculous amount of nothing. So by the time the Obama administration had come in, the fraud had gone so far that it was really impossible to wheel that back. Now, unfortunately, Galbraith came in after much of the institutional fraud had already been put into place. And so by the time the election was actually held, there really wasn't much you could do. Now, it is true that in the contesting of the election and all of the stuff that happened afterwards, that is when Kayyedi really lived down to the expectations of the UN in Afghanistan. Because, he was absolutely of the view that the best way to go forward was not to force this into any sort of, what would have happened in extrema would have been Karzai having a showdown with Abdullah. And Kayyedi, for whatever reason, wanted to preclude that. In point of fact, I don't know that even if there had been a runoff, that the outcome really would have been any differently. This is one of those elections where Karzai probably would have won even without the industrial strength fraud. And that's because the alternatives to Karzai didn't really have the national support base that one really needs to pull that off.
And a national support base means what? A network of narco-kleptocracy.
true. That's absolutely true. And of course, in Afghanistan, a lot of these patronage networks also have overlapping ties with, clan and ethnic affiliation. So Abdullah didn't have any of the weight in the south, the Pashtun south. Abdullah himself, his base is up in the north. So Karzai is one of those bizarre individuals that can pull. He's got the alliances in the north, but he is himself a Pashtun from Kandahar. So he's got those southern Pashtun ties. So by the way, after Karzai, elections always do produce alternatives. You sort of look at who's out in the field. It's hard to see who's going to be able to consolidate a position across the different parts of Afghanistan, especially when there's been so much ethnic fragmentation as a consequence of the war and the way in which the international community has interacted with Afghanistan.
Well, that gets us to the final question here, which is what's going to happen when the U.S. pulls out? Everybody seems to think that civil war is inevitable.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I hear. Now, let's be very clear what pullout means. Pullout does not mean, like the image of the fall of Saigon, the last helicopter pulling, as many people that could be safely shoved into a helicopter and flying away. The U.S. has made it very clear that they want to stay in some kind of a long-term committed relationship with Karzai or with Afghanistan. The problem is that Karzai wants the benefits of U.S. support without any of the political costs. And so you'll see him running around, kissing up to Emma Dainajad and so forth. And so Karzai knows that when the Americans leave, his regime is pretty fragile. But because his political position is fragile and because much of what the U.S. and NATO is doing in Afghanistan is deeply unpopular, he also wants to be in the constant position of the grouse, just constantly complaining about how horrible we are and how we haven't done enough and how we're all killing all these innocent civilians. So he's in a really tough place. But from my point of view, as an American, he's squandered the last 11 years. He has, during this time, the world had its checkbooks open. There was an opportunity to do something real, but he was really not able to overcome the sort of kleptocratic impulses of his regime. And, I'll tell you, everyone knows this. More money is being exported to Dubai than is Afghanistan's gross domestic product.
And that a lot of that is our money, right?
Precisely. And so, there, you know, if the American population understood how much money is being taken out of our pocket and basically being shoved into the pocket of these Afghan elites, so they can have their narco palaces, their poppy palaces in Dubai. I mean, it really is outrageous. And then to hear Karzai opine about how we haven't done enough. I mean, really, it's a little bit much. It's too much to take. It really is.
Well, let's not get upset you. We'll leave on that note.
This stuff gets me riled up.
Right, I know. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Somalia.
I heard his fiancée got a letter that told how Billy died that day. The letter said that he was a hero. She should be proud he died that way. I heard she threw the letter away.